Saturday, listeners, and welcome to the March 15, 2014 edition of this Saturday afternoon program. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I've got a great program for you today. But we're going to start with the fact that it's the day of the White Man's March, which is in actuality to be a series of independently conceived actions in support of whites and against policies of white genocide, such as the continuing immigration of non-whites into traditionally white countries. So I welcome anyone who is involved in an action of some kind to call in during the second hour after the music break to report what they're doing and how it looks. The number to call in the second hour is 1-833-443-4911, which you can find on the top right side of the White Network home page. So we're going to accept those calls in the second hour. Brief, if anybody wants to report something, and I've got the White Man March website up, and there's a few pictures on it of signs, and there's some big banners at the South Puget Sound Community College, and then some people writing some notes. That's about all I see there right now. But we're going to be hearing from our own radio host, Paul Hickman, in the second hour. He's going to call and join this call. And then he's going to tell us what happened in Birmingham, England, where he is doing something with some other people. And that's relevant because England is going to be the focus of this program today. But more broadly, the centennial we are marking this year of the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I in 1914, which certainly had a huge impact on white people. So we're all about white people today, as we often are, or even usually are, on the White Network. To talk about the World War I and all the future horrors that it unleashed, Mr. Richard Edmonds has returned to Saturday afternoon. We will just make a beginning today on this gigantic theme. We'll certainly be continuing it as the year progresses. So a big welcome to the distinguished longtime British nationalist, now associated with the National Front, Mr. Richard Edmonds. Thanks for being here, Richard.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Caroline. I'm obliged to you. Greatly so.
Oh, well, no need to be, but thank you. I'm obliged to you also. And isn't that a polite way to speak, I must say? Very nice. And I'm going to say something. I'll just start out, and then you can respond to it, or you can also go into whatever kind of, introductory message or words or whatever that you would like to tell the listeners about this huge subject that is what we need to be discussing and learning about this year. And so I'll just say that in February, there was an article in The Guardian, which is a mainstream, important British newspaper, that Britain has been constantly at war somewhere in the past 100 years. And they say that since Britain's declaration of war against Germany in August 1914, not a year has passed without its forces being involved in conflict. It's a statistic that has been largely overlooked and not one about which the government is likely to boast. So would you say that means Britain is a militaristic country? Because they also say that no one else has this record, even the countries that are considered to be more militaristic than Britain. But actually, the nation that's been most engaged in warfare continually has been Britain.
You want me to respond to that?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, yes, there's two immediate things one can say here. Yes, the British have been very warlike people for about 1,000 years. Ever since we were taken over by William the Conqueror in 1066. Yes, we have been involved in many wars. I think we have fought practically every European country many times over, except the Germans. We've only ever fought the Germans twice, in 1914 and 1939. Up until the First World War, Germany was an ally. North Germany was an ally of Britain. We have fought the French and we have fought the Spaniards for hundreds of years on end. In fact, you are speaking English, Mrs. Yeager, based in the United States of America, because we English, we British, successfully fought off the French, successfully fought off the Danes, successfully fought off the Spanish and settled English men and English women on that North American continent from which ultimately your Republic of the United States of America derives. However, going back to the Guardian newspaper, which you quote, the Guardian newspaper is a left liberal newspaper, and in general, you will find that they are against all wars. They're against every war you can imagine, except the First World War and the Second World War. They're a little ambiguous about the First World War, but the Second World War, as far as the Guardian newspaper, the left liberal internationalist, not to say international socialist, Guardian newspaper, sees the Second World War as the good war. I think it was one of your American authors named Studs Turtle. Studs Turtle. I think I've got his name
right. No, Turkle. With a C.
Yeah. He wrote a book entitled The Good War. Well, he would find the Guardian newspaper and all its journalists lining up to say, yes, Mr. Studs Turtle. What does Studs mean, for example? What sort of name is Studs, by the way?
Well, it's a nickname.
Okay.
I don't know. It doesn't mean anything, you know.
Okay. That's his Christian name, perhaps.
Well, no, I would say it's probably some nickname he grew up with and he just kept it.
Anyway, so that is that. However, in your introduction to this week's program, you asked the question, is it the British establishment which is so warlike, or the British people themselves? Do the British people have to answer for all of this? Let us usefully focus here on the two world wars. It is the two world wars which have done enormous damage to the whole white race, including the British people. And let us focus on these two wars. We don't have to go back to 1066 and William the Conqueror. Do you know who William the Conqueror was, by the way?
Well, was he the Norman?
Exactly. He was the Norman who was illegitimate, actually, but he fancied becoming King of England. So he came over here in 1066, and all the Anglo-Saxon aristocracy and all the Anglo-Saxon peasants, they all lined up, and William the Norman, with his cavalry, he charged over and he smashed all those Anglo-Saxon skulls in and marched through a sea of blood. And when he got to London, he said to the burghers of London, are you going to recognize me as your King of England, or shall I burn London to the ground? So all the burghers went on their knees and said, Hail King William the First. So that's how he conquered us. Incidentally, halfway along all this trouble and strife, our King Harold had managed to get killed in the battle. So we needn't go back to 1066.
I don't think it's a bad idea, because I like what you just said. It's very enlightening. But the British people have been changed over all this time to be adapted to the Norman style of being more ruthless and warlike and getting ahead by defeating your enemy.
Getting ahead by defeating our enemies. Well, anyway, that's another story. I take it you have not questioned my claim that you are speaking English, Mrs. Yeager, in the fine Republic of the United States of America, simply because we Englishmen conquered that territory. No.
Well, because I don't find that particularly relevant. Yes, the English came over and they were the dominant. They were dominant and they remained dominant. In fact, up until the early 20th century, Henry Ford was putting out his articles about the international Jew, and he made it plain over and over that this was he considered this an Anglo-Saxon country. Still, well, majority Anglo-Saxon.
I only mentioned the English colonizing of North America because you said we English, we British. To me, England and Britain are one of the same country. English and British are one of the same peoples. you said in your introduction that we British were very aggressive and fought all these wars. So I just reminded you and your American listeners that you owe us a lot in the past. However, let us focus on this dreadful century of the last 100 years. Yes, let's focus on that, shall we?
Well, I want to focus on the question that I asked, which would be, what were the causes of World War I? Because we know that World War II came out of that. And I know that you have an idea, you have something that you want to present, but I don't know that, I don't know if it will be I don't know yet if it'd be as instructive, but I want to get to the deeper questions, you see. Now, we know why. We know the obvious as to why all this happened, don't we?
I don't know that we do.
Well, you start out then. But let's start with World War I, because people don't understand that. And this is the anniversary year of World War I, 2014. And this is where I think we should start out anyway, looking.
I think I would say that most people in Europe, possibly most people in America, and most people in Britain think that World War I was caused by Germany declaring war on Britain. But that wasn't the fact. It was the British government that declared war on Germany in 1914 and thereby launched the First World War. And just 25 years later, it was the British government, again for the second time, that declared war on Germany in September 39, mm-hmm. and not the other way around.
Well, you know, I put that little chart there on the announcement to the program, and I will use that for the program post, too. And I thought it was a very good chart, because a lot of people... our knowledge of World War I is not nearly as good as our knowledge of World War II, you know, most living people today. And World War II pretty much eclipsed the talk about World War I. But a lot of people would not even be clear, and I'm not clear until I'm reminded of it again, about things like this. Just who was on, just how did this thing line up and who was on whose side? And I don't even know now where I was going with that. But that little, you were talking about World War One. Continue after I said that. People might refer to that little chart there. It's made up of circles.
That chart is useful. Certainly is useful. In Britain, see, you make a distinction in your introduction, the British establishment or the British people. To me, there is a huge, huge gulf between the British establishment, the politicians, on the one hand, and the British people on the other. In the First World War, 1 million British soldiers were killed in the First World War. 1 million. And several million came back home, mutilated, minus their arms, their legs, their eyesight. And on the continent, the French losses, the German losses, the Russian losses were even higher. And people spoke of the lost generation. We're talking of the First World War, not the one that came 20 years later. We're talking of the First World War, where Europe's finest, most patriotic, most idealistic were slaughtered in 4 years of mindless warfare. Now, a question arises, and all the time I'm focused on your point. Who was responsible for this, the British government or the British people? And I will say to you every time, the British establishment.
Let me just throw this in here. You talked about the British establishment last time you were on, which was, I think, just 2 weeks ago. I linked to it, but I think it was just two Saturdays ago that we were talking about some of these things. And you were kept mentioning the British establishment lied to the people, the British establishment did this, and all the guilt. But, you know, I say over a period of a lot of years, and I say this about everybody, every nation, why do the people allow it? You know, what happens to people? Why are we so easily taken over and made fearful and so on? Well, I do know why, but I mean, I think we have to hold ourselves somewhat responsible. Otherwise, there is no end to it, right? I mean, British establishment exists privilege of the British people, if they understood if they could ever unify and get together.
Yes, absolutely. We are responsible, as they say, people get the government they deserve. Of course, the mass of people are responsible, and it certainly takes two to tango, as they say. However, I will put it to you, looking as we are now over 100 years, over a centenary of a catastrophe, 1914, 2014, two world wars, and now mass immigration, which, as you said in your introduction, this mass third world immigration into all white countries, but only white countries, will lead to the destruction of the white race. It will lead to our genocide. Now I put it to you that firstly, we whites, we're a very fine people. We've created this modern civilization. We're a fine people. And I will secondly put to you that no people in the history of mankind has been so betrayed by their nominal leaders as have the whole white race, Britain and the United States particularly. I'd like to speak about the US of A later. You're such an important country. One has to talk about you. But
well, I'd like to say something about the United States right now, because I don't have any kind of defensive feeling or desire to defend the United States at all. As I already said, that the United States was formed and is basically Anglo-Saxon, based on those kinds of ideas and political structures and so on. So it's basically Anglo-Saxon, and so is the United Kingdom, Great Britain, Anglo-Saxon. And I just will suggest that in the Anglo-Saxon mentality, whether the original indigenous people of the British Isles had it or not, but they have acquired it then, of a kind of a certain kind of, it might not, it in the upper classes it can appear to be arrogance, or in the governments often it can appear to be arrogance, but it's a kind of patriotism that tells them that they have to be right, and they believe that they're always right. I think the Anglo-Saxons believe that they're always right, and it's good to have an identity, a strong identity that you don't want to lose and think you're good. We don't want to, you know, think we're lesser than or guilty of things that we're not guilty of. But I do think it's kind of taken over, and that is the reason why the British people are able to be talked in to these things that the establishment wants them to do, because they instill them with this idea that, well, we have to stand up for, you know, our proud traditions and nation and so on, to the extent that they will accept liars and thieves and deceptive leaders. Now I got to say that. I wanted to say that. You can tear into that all you want now, Richard. I invite you to if you feel it's necessary, because I got that all out. Okay.
Well, I don't think it's part of our traditions just to accept lies. I don't think that's at all. We've had, if you go back a little way into our history, we had men and women who were burnt to death because they wouldn't accept lies. However, I don't want to go into all that, the mists of history. I want to focus on the question you put. Why do the people of Britain why do they tolerate all of this? Why do they? In particular, why do they tolerate the mass slaughter of their young men in two world wars? And why do they tolerate this ongoing genocidal mass immigration from the rest of the world? And I will say to you, and I've thought about this for years, of course, which is why I'm very glad, very pleased to be debating it with you. I have no doubt that what is being done to the whole white race, in particular what is being done to the British people, and I would suggest to the American people, but I want to focus on Britain, what is being done to the British people is almost, without precedent. Our people have been betrayed by their natural or nominal leaders, we've been very brave. We fought wars for them. We have paid our taxes. We've worked hard. And it is difficult for the average man to comprehend the scale of the betrayal. I could say to you that I'm going to quote something I wrote the other day because I had this talk in mind and I wrote this down. 100 years ago, I want to quote something. You allow me to quote something, yeah? Which I personally wrote, yeah?
Yes, yes. I think that you said it to me. You go right ahead. It was very good.
Okay. 100 years ago, in 1914, the British establishment initiated the genocide of our white race when it launched the first of the series of world wars. And these wars have now mutated into an undeclared war organized by the same corrupt Anglo-American establishment, because this is a tandem act. It's not just done by the British government. They haven't got the power to do it. It's the Anglo-American establishment, an undeclared war, because no one will speak the truth, an undeclared war of unlimited mass immigration into the white homelands of Britain, Europe, North America, and the other white lands overseas. The question is, why do people tolerate this? They can see it with their own eyes. And I will say to you, firstly, what is happening to us is so without precedent and is so wicked and it's such an enormous scale. It takes people's literally breath away. And I have spent 40 years of my adult life trying to grapple with this, as well as trying to alert people and to organize them to oppose their wicked establishment. But I'll also say to you, as I said in the earlier talk that I had on your show 2 years ago, 2 weeks ago, the British establishment lies in a manner which I don't think any other leadership has ever lied to its own people. Can I go back to the First World War briefly?
Sure. Yeah, that's what we want to talk about, the First World War.
The question is, the British lost 1 million young men in the First World War. Now, those young men were all patriotic.
Well, the million included all the dominions and colonies. Right. Well, it was 700,000 actual from British, and that's what I read. But if you included Australia, Canada, and every other group that fought up with the British of their colonies and so on, then it was 1 million.
Listen, back to 1914, the white colony, the white dominions that were dominions of Australia, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the whites in South Africa were regarded as British, 100% British. They could come and go. And a lot of those men who fought in the Canadian army in France, who fought in the Australian army in the Middle East or in Turkey at Gallipoli or in France, many of those men who wore New Zealander, Canadian, South African or Australian uniforms were in fact British men who had emigrated to those countries in the years before the First World War. But they were all regarded as British. So when I talk about 1 million dead, I mean 1 million British dead. And there were hardly any coloured troops involved, hardly any. If we had a few Indian troops that were left in India, it was white men who were being killed. The question is, if you travel around Britain and if you travel around France and if you travel around Germany, you will see war memorials everywhere. Every town, every city, every small village has got war memorials listing the names of young men, and they were all young men, patriotic, idealistic, king and country, rushed off to volunteer. Britain fought the first 2 years of the First World War on volunteers. Only later, when they run out of soldiers, if I may use that ghastly phrase, did they introduce conscription. The French, Germans, the Russians, the Austrians had conscription from day one. Our first 2 years was volunteers. They were so patriotic. There are war memorials all over Britain listing in small villages dozens of names, in large towns hundreds, thousands of names. How did the British government get the British people to cheer on their sons, their brothers, their sweethearts, their fathers, their husbands? How did they get the British people to cheer their sons and brothers and sweethearts to march away, many of them never to return? How was that done? Well, I'll tell you, the politicians, they lied. The British people were saturated on the news media, mainly newspapers in those days, with the British government falsely alleging that the German soldiers that our troops were fighting in northern France, in Flanders, in Belgium, that the German soldiers in the First World War were committing atrocities. The British government falsely claimed that German soldiers were cutting off the hands of Belgian children, and the British government falsely claimed that the German soldiers were crucifying nuns. Yeah, they said that repeatedly. Mm-hmm. By means.
Yeah, I'm looking for something here. Whenever I'm looking for something, I can't find it. But there was an article, and which one was it? Or it was from a book that said, oh, here it is, right here. It said, this was the one by Reynolds. There were three books being reviewed it was being reviewed by Peter Clark. It was on Financial Times, recently about, you know, the centenary and so on. And this writer said, some Belgians became the victims of German atrocities, which certainly took place, he writes. And I thought, what? And then he said, and were also certainly used in British propaganda, but he didn't say they made it up, said they used it, and were equally certainly widely disbelieved after the war. But he does say that that these atrocities did take place against the Belgians. What do you say about that?
I say, this is a recent quote from the London Financial Times that you're quoting, yes?
Yeah, it's from a book, and I believe there are three authors, and this author's name was Reynolds. This is from the first book.
Well, you must understand that we live in an age of lies. Our British Prime Minister, David Cameron, is getting ready to celebrate the beginning of the First World War, and he is claiming that we in Britain owe all of our freedoms, including freedom of speech, to the fact that Britain fought that first good war, the First World War. Well, as I said to you in our last talk 2 weeks ago, there is no freedom of speech in Britain. If you criticise the criminal proclivities of blacks, you're liable to get 7 years in prison in Britain. 7 years. You can even go to prison if you quote the Bible.
Yeah.
That's how tyrannic.
Well, that's terrible. I mean, I know that's true, too. But now, I was just surprised that a supposedly respected historian would still say that certainly some of these atrocities against the Belgians by the Germans took place. But that's what he's saying here.
Well, what does he mean by atrocities? The First World War was a bloody contest in which millions of men were killed, in which whole areas of northern France and Belgium were devastated by 4 years of war. There's no doubt that sometimes civilians were caught up in the fighting and the shelling. What's the word atrocity mean? What is a
fact? Well, that's it. You see, and that's what's so bad about this, you know. And they should know better. They shouldn't still be doing this, you know. But they'll say something like that and leave it kind of unclear. But people naturally think of the atrocities that they talked about, cutting off children's hands or starving people or doing this, that, and the other thing. You know, that's what people think of when they say atrocity. Something that someone did sadistically that did not have to happen. Not just general, you know, mayhem of war. So I'm just surprised that there are still some British who won't let this go.
I'm surprised that you're surprised at learning that the British establishment are total liars. They've been lying for 100 years. They're not going to start admitting the truth now. The British establishment was forced to admit the truth. When the First World War was over, various truth seekers, independent investigators, and to give them credit, American journalists, went to Belgium looking for children who'd had their hands chopped off. They were looking for nuns, the corpses of nuns who'd been crucified. And these independent investigators, these truth seekers, amongst some American journalists, I can discuss in a minute the motive of these American journalists. I'm sure it's very important from your perspective and from my perspective. These truth seekers revealed that it was all propaganda lies invented by the British government. And the British government was forced in 1922 to publicly apologize to the German army and to the German people for the vile lies, that the British government issued during the Second World War. So that's the answer to that journalist from the Financial Times. Look, they paid a lot of money to come out with the systems. In the Soviet Union, the journalists all sung the song for the Soviet Union. Well, we live in a tyranny over here, a tyranny of lies. But that is the fact. The fact is the British government admitted their disgusting, vile lies, which they had used to incite the British people to fight the war in the first place. The British government officially apologized in 1922 to the German army and to the German people. Incidentally, since I'm talking to an American, since it's my pleasure, ma'am, to be talking to you this fine afternoon, and I can tell you here in London town, the sun is just sinking. It's probably in the, anyway, I can tell you that, the British government, in addition to apologizing to the German army and to the German people, should really have also apologized to the American people, because there's no doubt these propaganda lies issued by the British government during the First World War, that the Germans were Huns cutting off children's hands, had a very, very big effect on the American public and helped stampede the American public into supporting the First World War on the side of the British Empire. And those journalists, those fine investigative journalists, American journalists, who went to Flanders, who went to Belgium looking for children minus their hands and nuns had been crucified, they were American journalists who seriously doubted the word of the British government, but they wanted to verify the truth. Had the British been speaking the truth during the Second World War, or had the British government been lying? And surprise, surprise, these American journalists found out that the British government had been lying. You may know, I'm sure you do know, that during the First World War, there were many Americans of Irish origin, for example, Americans of German origin, for example, or Americans who were simply Republican-minded, who were totally opposed to the American people pulling the chestnuts out the fire that the British Empire, pulling the British Empire's chestnuts out of the fire. They, American citizens, didn't see why they should send their sons to fight and die for the aggrandizement of the British Empire. There was a lot of opposition. They were called isolationists. They were called American firsters. And it was these journalists from this particular school of thought, isolationist school of thought, who went to Belgium after the war to see the British government had been lying to the American people. Of course, there was collusion between the British establishment and the American establishment. The American establishment got great gains out of that First World War, and even more out of the Second World War, which is why the American establishment allowed the British establishment to spread all their lies in America in the years 1914, 1915, 1916, until they got the entry of America in April 1917. Those
are British lies. Sorry? No, I was just going to say, your Skype is garbling up just a little bit, but luckily it's not so bad that we can't understand you. But I thought I'd let you know that you're not coming through real clear. But it's the kind of thing that often clears up.
Was I speaking too quickly?
No, I don't think that. Just speak loud enough. You're speaking loud enough. No, I've been able to understand it, but it's the Skype connection gets a little troubled. Sounds kind of garbly, or like you're underwater or something. So I just thought I'd let you know. So I'll just use this opportunity to say something myself and hope this will clear up on its own. That, how do you explain that the British establishment became so anti-Britain or so anti-white? How do you explain that they got so rotten?
Well, that is a key question. I think the explanation is more to be found in the demoralization of the British people. You can say the First World War was an error, a mistake, And the Second World War was a crime against the white race. Am I clearer now?
No, you're not. We might ask you to hang up and call again, but you have to hang up the Skype phone call, which means that where that little circle with the red, that little red circle with the white phone in it, that little small icon.
Yeah, yeah.
That you need to hang that, you need to click on that and hang up, and then you will. But sometimes it's hard to find the white network again, but you have to find the white network again on your call, on your contact list. And recall. Do you see it there now? Do you know where it is? Because
I can see it. Can you hear me better now? Am I better now?
No.
So I'll phone up and phone back, yeah?
Yeah, I think maybe this Skype connection has gone bad. So if you just try doing that and then call in after you hang up, just look for the white network and call it again.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Caroline.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's hope he can find. When I hung up, I couldn't find the white network again. It somehow disappeared. But I think that problem has been changed because here he is already again.
Oh,
hi, Richard. Yes, you sound much better. Yeah.
Pleased to hear that.
Okay, good. So if you can remember where you were, well, I just because of that, I brought in the question about why the British establishment was so bad.
I'll answer that question, yes?
Yes.
It's not so much the British establishment is bad. It most certainly is. The problem is the demoralization of the British people. And I think the demoralization of the whole white race, certainly of all white people in Western Europe. Consider the First World War, 1 million British soldiers were killed, more than 1 million French soldiers were killed, 2 million German soldiers were killed, several million Russian soldiers were killed in the First World War. 20 years later, we had the Second World War, again initiated by the British government in declaring war on Germany. In the Second World War, 50 million people were killed. 50 million. Europe was devastated. The people in Europe were starving. Their cities were smoldering ruins. Britain was bankrupt in 1945. We were dependent on American loans just to live. And that tremendous losses makes the survivors of the war cynical. The attitude then becomes, in German, ohne mich, without me. I don't care about anything. I just want to look after myself. Patriotism. The word patriotism comes to mean the officer in the First World War blowing the whistle. The brave officer goes over the top. The men all go over the top. And within 5 minutes, they're all machine gun dead by the enemy machine guns. Whether the officer is an English officer, a French officer, a German officer, or a Russian officer, it makes the survivors cynical. And that Second World War did enormous moral damage to the survivors. It made them cynical. It made patriotism a bad word. That patriotism equals the officer blowing the whistle, all the men going over the top, the officer included, and all shot dead. And people thought, I will just look after myself. And in addition, the British people in the First World War and the whole white race since the Second World War have been saturated with lies. I've described the lies in the First World War, the wicked allegations against the Germans, and in the Second World War, following the Second World War, the Allies justified the Second World War with even more lies, which make lies and allegations in the first instance against the Germans, but now lies and allegations against all white people. And in the end, the people are so demoralized, they mentally retreat into their shells and they just let the world pass them by. And that in practice allows the wicked, cynical, corrupt establishment to do more or less whatever it likes. Would you, if you're satisfied with that answer in itself, and if you can still hear me clearly, would you want me, I've talked about the lies whereby the British establishment incited the British people and later the American people to hate and to wish to fight the Germans. Do you wish me to give to examine the propaganda lies which have so demoralized the whole white race now by the lies by which the British, the British establishment and the Anglo-American establishment justifies their Second World War. Would you like me to discuss?
Yeah, sure. But you know, at the same time, would you also comment on who these people are, these wicked establishment British people? You know, why they became this way? What is their what is their interest? Why would they be doing this to the British people, et cetera? So, you know, I think you know what I mean. And I think we need to, that's a part of the whole, the whole answer to these questions.
Before I answer the question which is hanging in the air between you and me, somewhere mid-Atlantic, I think, let me say what the British... Let me... Look, it's the Anglo-American...
Sure, go ahead. I asked the question, so you go ahead now.
Okay. The long-term aim of the Anglo-American establishment is to set up a society comparable to that society in that very large country in South America where the language is Portuguese. I'm not going to say the country, though it's obvious what I'm talking about. And what I'm going to describe is a caricature of the society that exists in that large country in on the South American continent where they speak Portuguese. The long-term aim of the wicked Anglo-American establishment is to have a society where you have 1% or 5%, maybe 5% of very, very wealthy people, millionaires and billionaires. You have an underclass, a criminal underclass who live in the favelas, I believe that's the word, the slums, who live in absolute misery, deprivation, crime. And in that's the underclass, the lower underclass. And in between the fabulously rich 1% or 5% and this criminal underclass, you have maybe 30% or 40% of what you might call the working middle class, the people who make the country work, from train drivers and bus drivers to accountants and engineers and school teachers and lawyers, people who work and who make the country work. And this middle class is being squeezed systematically and wickedly between the ruling elite, millionaires and billionaires, and the criminal underclass, which is lapping at their feet. And all those in the working middle class have no security of tenure, no security at all, and they fear constantly losing their position, losing their job, losing their savings and losing their pensions to enormous inflation. They fear constantly falling from the working middle class into that criminal underclass. Well, compare that, Caroline, to the America that you and I knew, because I think we're about the same age group. If you compare that to the America when you and I were young, which to us Brits was a fabulous land, the United States of the 1950s was our golden, fabulous land to us over here in Britain. In the United States, in the 1950s, you had, let us say, 90% of Americans were members of the working middle class. They had good jobs, good pay. They had a secure future. They had secure pensions to look forward to. There was effectively no inflation, so your savings weren't destroyed. And they lived a good life, a secure life. And I think the idea of the wicked establishment, the wicked Anglo-American establishment, is to destroy that working middle class, to take away their security, to take away their decent standard of living, and to turn them into working serfs and slaves who have to obey the rules, or they fear being thrown into the favelas, the dangerous slums of the underclass, which is lapping at their feet at all times. And I think that is the purpose, to destroy us, to destroy the decent people who are the fundament of any nation, those who work, those who pay the taxes, those who are honest, Those who are patriotic, those who send their sons off to fight for the wars when they're asked to do so. And I think that is the long-term aim.
But Richard, what is to be gained by doing that? what do they gain by changing society from what would be great for all of us to something that is like out of George Orwell, 1984?
Well, because if there are losers, there's going to be winners. And the guys at the top, the guys and the gals at the top who are millionaires and billionaires in Brazil, well, I've named the country now, in Brazil, wealthy people don't drive cars. The streets are too dangerous. They fly around in helicopters. They have personal bodyguards with machine guns. They live a life unknown to the rest of us. But there are men and women who enjoy that and who want it. And if they're not stopped politically, democratically, through the ballot box, if they're not stopped in Britain, and if they're not stopped in the US of A and other white countries, they will come up with that.
But would you accept the term psychopath for these people?
They're human beings. We've already discussed the innate aggression inside human beings when we were focusing on the British English people post 1066.
If these people who are already living in this super high level fabulous life as the elite, you think that then their children who grow up in that want to perpetuate that, and those of us who don't grow up in it feel a sense of allegiance to our own kind of people, and so we have our ideas of what we think society should be, but these others nobody who is born into that changes their mind or wants to do anything different.
They all
want to continue to be winners.
Of course, that's human nature. Of course, they will take it for granted. Meanwhile, the likes of you and I and the millions of people like us, the working middle class, who are the bedrock of any successful society, it's up to us, democratically and legally and lawfully, to thwart the ambitions of these people. But at the moment, they've been winning for a long time. But that's just how it is. That's just how it is. But that is their long-term aim, and they're getting closer to it. You may know that in the United States of America,
to be fabulously rich. Is that, that's it? To be fabulously rich and beyond any kind of, the rule of law or any kind of, punishment or change in their fortunes.
Absolutely correct. That is their aim, to be fabulously rich and to be beyond the law, because they own the law, because they own the politicians, to be fabulously rich, to be beyond the law, and certainly beyond having to answer our questions. Yes, that is their aim. That is their aim. Look, we have seen this in the Oriental world, that when the Turks had sultans, the Turkish sultan was above the law because he was the law. He had a harem of 500 women, for example, could do what he liked. And all his emirs, they could do what they liked. And they had a harem of 300 women. And so it all went on. This is what the present people in the present Anglo-American society establishment want, with or without the harems. I've got no idea. I just threw
that. Well, that brings the sex into it. And why that always comes out as such a big, important part, that they are able to have these, what do you call them? They're able to have the slave trade, the white slave trade, the child slave trade, and so on, and all of these privileges, sexual decadence that they partake of are true, and they become addicted to all of that, maybe.
Maybe. I wouldn't know myself. I have to.
I know. We don't know, you see. I mean, that's why it's hard to get this across to ordinary people. Because they can't imagine that anybody would, not more than a few crazy people, you know, a few odd extreme cases would be like that. It's hard to imagine that whole areas of government, or that your political leaders and your government leaders and all kinds of politicians all indulge in this and then don't say anything about it.
Let me say here, in a sense, ordinary people in one sense, don't have to focus on these luxurious lives of the 1%. Ordinary people have to focus on the fact that the politicians, whatever their motives, are not acting in the best interest of the American people in your country or acting in the interest of the my people in Great Britain. That's all that one has to focus on. And as you said, I'm a member of the National Front, and we wish to come to political power. We want our ideas and ideals to decide the future of Britain. And the way to do that is to vote out of office, the so-called conservatives in Britain, the so-called socialists in Britain, and your equivalents in the United States of America, the Republicans and Democrats, yes, and replace them by patriotic brave men and women.
Well, yes. Okay. And so we keep going to the election process, but we don't make any progress. And there is criticism that the people who keep going up for election cannot be elected. And these people in our, you know, our regular hardworking middle class people don't vote these horrible creatures out of office. It's an amazing thing. So that it comes down to that we are totally subject to whatever the, it's not even brainwashing, to whatever the media indoctrination is or the media spiel, what we mostly see and hear, or what we think most people, what is considered to be what everybody agrees on, most people agree on, and so they just keep going along with it. They're afraid to take a chance. Well, they fall for the demonization and so on.
Well, two answers to that. You have some very brave men and women in America, and you've had brave men and brave women in America for the last 100 years. I could mention names. As for the demonization now, Caroline, I won't talk about the United States of America, but if you want to talk about demonization, I would like to talk about demonization in a political context, now or later. How do you want to play?
Well, we've only got a few minutes left, maybe three or something like that. So just mention quickly what you have to say about that, and then we'll go to the break and see what comes up after the break.
Well, I would just say here, demonization of patriots plays a key role in this business, and one of the reasons why ordinary, patriotic, decent, working, middle-class Americans and ditto in Great Britain do not vote for us is because people on our part of the spectrum, people that are part of the political spectrum, are demonized systematically by the establishment's media. And that is a very important subject in itself, and I would like to talk about that either this evening or this evening here, either now in the second half or on another occasion. But you've got to do a roundup of what's been happening to all these white.
Well, we'll see if there is one. I don't know. You know, I'll check that website, and we've got 60 seconds now, and I'll announce the phone number again. And if people want to call in, and there might not be anybody, and then Paul is going to call in, and then we'll probably I assume really that we won't spend too much time on this, and then we'll get back to our subject. So I'm sure you'll be able to talk about that. And in the meantime, during the break, I'll see if I've got any concerns left that I haven't addressed yet to you. And you do the same. Let's see. Our break music is Richard. I don't know what was on 2 weeks ago, but we have some really Americana music, a super American type, soft kind of, even the second one is kind of country western. So I hope you enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in 5 minutes with Richard Edmonds on the Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn.
Down in the valley, valley so low, hang your head over, hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow, dear, hear the wind blow. Hang your head over, hear the wind blow. If you don't love me, love whom you please. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease.
Give my heart ease, dear, give my heart ease. Throw your arms round me, give my heart ease.
Roses love sunshine, violets love dew. Angels in heaven know I love you. Know I love you, dear. Know I love you. Angels in heaven. This valley, they say you are leaving. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile. For they say you are taking the sunshine that has brightened our pathway wild. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true. For a long time, my darling, I've waited for the sweet word. To go in the way. How about a mandolin solo? This is the verse that that makes me think I kind of know why the guy's going away. Because she is whining. Do you think of the valley you're leaving? Oh, how lonely, how drear it will be. Do you think of the kind heart you're breaking? And the pain that you're causing to me. Come and sit by my side if you love me. Do not hasten to bid me adieu. Just remember the Red River Valley and the one who has loved you so true.
Take it, friend.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to you too, Richard. And we are now going to take a look at see if what's going on with the white man's activity, white man march activities, which is basically most of the signs are about diversity equals white genocide. And I see some new entries here on this website. Well, and there's a sign, diversity equals white genocide, on, looks like a stall door in a restroom. But there, these are nice banners, white on black. Somebody had them printed up, and they, and then there's, you see, then, but then we have, some new pictures of, overpasses with large banners. This one says, diversity is just a code word for white genocide. That's pretty much the popular way that, you know, that it's done. It's a overpass somewhere. It doesn't say where. And there's another one on an overpass at night. Of course, it can be nighttime in some places, dark. There's one here, something on a, looks like it's a mailbox. Somebody stuck something. See, this is, pretty minor, I have to say. I mean, I just have to be honest. There's a few people out there who are trying to do something, but it's not a large number. And Richard, you yourself said you had first had heard, the first you had heard about it was on my show announcement where I mentioned it.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
This kind of goes in with what we're talking about is, how, in fact, it very much does, how to get white people to care enough to do things, because most white people, say, in this large country of the United States of America, are not interested in such things. And I wouldn't participate, and they don't probably even like the phrase diversity equals white genocide, because they don't get it that there's a white genocide, and they don't have a problem with the word diversity, because most of them are so conditioned to think that it's better to have some diversity. But when they see too much, then they know it's not right. But you have to get to that way too much point before people start to wake up, and then you're so far gone, it's very hard to do anything about it. I know 2 weeks ago you said when our countries get so bad that there's nothing left for anybody, and I mean really nothing, everything's broken down, then these people will leave because they have nothing to gain from it. I have to say I thought, oh, that's not a very good solution. I mean, I wouldn't look forward to that. But anyway, there's a lot of new pictures here that, you know, people put up little signs along roads, but you big enough to read them as you go by, and signs out along highways. So there we go. And the number, if you have something to talk about, you know, in a fairly brief way, call 1-830-443-4911, all you white activists out there, and we'd like to hear from you. And we'll also be willing to, at this point, for Paul to come on if he's ready to do so. Anytime he's ready, he can come on. He can just come on by himself. There we are, Richard. What do you think of this? What do you think of this activity that an American white activist came up with? But they didn't, as I say, I think they found out quickly that they could not organize a real march anywhere. And so they just said, well, we don't think we should even have a march. We should just have activists go out and do things. But when people do things on their own like that, you don't get very many people. And that's kind of, for me also, the difference between, a good comparison between the idea of a movement or political parties or membership organizations versus that some people, I suppose mostly Americans, have this lone wolf idea that organizations attract the wrong kind of attention and they attract infiltration and so on. And so we should just have people, white people, going out and doing things in maybe small groups or by themselves, doing pro-white activities without talking about it and without anybody knowing who they are, things like that. You just function as a, on your honor as an activist. What would you have to say about that?
Well, what would I have to say? Well, first of all, it is very difficult for me as a British person to speak about the United States in this context of white realist, white nationalist, race realist street activities. I will say, in the United States, in the last 100 years, in the 20s and 30s up to the present time, you had some wonderfully brave, articulate, educated, fine men and women. Very, very fine. But, and there's a but, it does seem to me, for whatever reason, you've never had a party in the United States of America comparable to the Front National in France. The French, the Front National, can organize thousands of people to march through the center of Paris and other French cities. British nationalists, when we were properly organized, have equally had thousands of people march through British cities carrying our Union Jack flag. In France, they carry the tricolor, of course.
There is a reason for that. There is an answer for that. There is a reason for that, Richard. Well, it's our party system, our party system, a two-party system, and you have to jump through all kinds of hoops and do almost the impossible to be able to get on the ballot. You have to get on the ballot in every state to have a chance, and it's very hard. Most parties start out and they get on the ballot and say in California and a few big states, and then they try to make a showing there. And the other thing is that we have all winner takes all here. That's even the bigger thing. Where, and I don't know how it is actually in Britain, but in Europe, they have a different system in most countries where they have, even if you have a smaller number, you get a certain number of representatives in parliament. Well, we don't have that. You have to win, and you win it all, or you lose. A new party can never win.
Well, in Britain, we also have winner take all. But at one time, the British National Party had 100 local government councillors elected to town halls.
We don't have councillors like that. Well, we have parties. Everything's the political party here. And you have the political, those are party positions, aren't they? You have the party, and they have their own, activities in every state, and they organize and so on. Go on.
Sorry. But in Britain, it's the same, I think. In an election to be a town councillor, you'll have a Conservative candidate, you'll have a Labour candidate, you'll have a Liberal candidate, you might have a Green candidate, you might even have a Communist candidate. And if you've got a British nationalist candidate, he's got to get more votes than any other. It's winner take all. And we still had 100 councillors at one time. And also, we have problems in Britain and Europe, which you do not have in America. We've had our leaders have been put in jail. John Tyndall was put in jail when he was a chairman of the British National Party, given a year's prison sentence. On the front, on the continent of Europe, you've had men murdered. Right-wingers, nationalists have been murdered by their left-wing opponents. Jean-Marie Le Pen was constantly in court being harassed. I just think one just has to say that there is this difference. But I would say of these...
Well, I agree with you. I do agree with you. And Europeans have a better history of being involved in political, not just politics, but trying to gain ground with their parties and so on. And then, I don't know, in the United States, I think we thought we were separate from all the rest of the world, and we had the best of everything here. And therefore, we went along pretty much, and we fell for the left-right divide. All we needed was one party on each side, and they represented things. There's a lot of complacency here, and it worked for a long time because we didn't have the problems that Europe had and the rest of the world. It was really kind of terrible, how Americans are, and they still have this feeling. It has to change this feeling that we can solve our things our own way, and we don't need to be. The political powers that be want to get Americans to think that they need to be concerned about everything else that's going on in the world and get involved in it. But that's kind of a different thing than your own politics. I don't have a clear-cut answer for that at all, but I know exactly what you're saying, and you're right.
Well, yes, there was a time when you Americans were separate from the rest of the world. When I lived in Canada 40 years ago, when I took that Greyhound bus trip all around the United States of America for $99, wonderful value for money. Yeah, sure. Well, you had to work up. $99 was a week's wages in that Canadian nickel smelter where I was working. But it was wonderful value for money. And I thought to myself, if these Americans had any sense whatsoever, they would draw up the drawbridge. You know what a drawbridge is, don't you? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You had the medieval castle and you had the drawbridge. Once you draw the drawbridge up, you can't get into the castle. And I thought to myself, these Americans have got a wonderful country. They should draw the drawbridge up and tell the rest of the world to solve its own problems and just live in your wonderful continent. But because you have not followed the advice of George Washington, your first president with his English name, George Washington, you know, by the way, Caroline, don't you, that if George Washington in his rebellion against our King George III, you know what would have happened to George Washington if he'd lost that revolt of his? You know what the redcoats would have done to him, don't you? You do know, don't you?
Sorry, my attention was diverted just a little bit. I was sending a message to Paul.
And a message to Paul. Come in, Paul. Your time is up. Anyway, I was saying, you Americans have a wonderful... But the advice that George Washington gave you, he gave you the advice not to go abroad looking for monsters to fight.
Right.
And you ignored that advice.
Right.
You've ignored it. Ever since, was it McKinley, was it, who took the Philippines off the Spaniards? Was it McKinley who did that? I think it was
I don't know. but I will say that those same people, it has to be the same people who you're talking about in Britain that want the people of the United States to get all involved in the rest of the world, because we didn't need to, and we were kind of like a model for the rest of the world, and everybody looked to America and looked up to America. Maybe it was an illusion what they were looking up to, but in any case, we were encouraged not to be that way, and that we were terribly self-centered and too smug, and we needed to understand all the suffering in the rest of the world and engage ourselves in doing something about it.
Very noble. Yeah. Shall we talk about the demonization
of
political
parties?
Yeah. And
yes,
I think that is why, in my opinion, your white nationalists in America find it difficult to make any headway because of the demonization. Certainly, I will speak of demonization in Britain, and I know it's exactly the same in France, in Holland, in Germany, and elsewhere in Western Europe. The demonization takes this form. Can you hear me? Can you?
Yes, you're coming very clear.
Do you want to speak to Paul Hickman? Do you want to speak to him?
Oh, there he is. He's here.
Hi,
Paul. We'll just say hello to him.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. And Richard's here.
Hiya, Paul.
Hello, Richard. Enjoying the show so far?
I'm enjoying it so far, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it right to the end.
Good.
Well, Paul, you know, Richard, now that Paul did come on, and you're just getting started with the demonization, let Paul tell us what he has to tell us, and then we'll get back to the main topic again. How's that?
That's fine.
So, Paul, what kind of experiences did you have today?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had quite a good day. We chose the Aston Expressway in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. We attached a banner off a bridge. It's very busy underneath the Aston Expressway. You've got traffic going to the motorway, the M6 for London, south, and you've got traffic going for the motorway M6 north towards Liverpool. So I would estimate you've got 200 or 300 cars probably going past every minute. So we attached our banner, anti-racist is a code word for anti-white, to the bridge. We also attached a black Celtic cross flag, and we also had a National Front flag flying on a flagpole. We got quite a lot of bibs and that kind of support from cars and trucks. We took some footage, which will be edited, and we've got some photos. Then we finished off in Birmingham City Centre and used some stickers. We had some National Action stickers and some National Front stickers, and we used about 100 of those. So that was our main activity today, and the idea is that people have done this kind of thing across the globe, and then the videos will be sent to the people who are organising the White Man March, and a big collage will be made to kind of inspire other people to do things in the future. And that's the main idea. So all in all, the day went quite well.
Well, good. You know, I'm looking at this site here again, and the two new entries. But you know, I'm miss honesty, so I have to always say what I see, even if it's not maybe what they would like me to say. But I see, yeah, there's two pictures in two different locations, but it's the same two men holding the same banner, I take it. They may not be too far apart, but they're holding it. They don't have it put up somewhere permanently. Mm-hmm. They're walking around. Well, I guess that's not bad either. They're walking around and going to different places and unfurling and then getting the picture taken. So that will be a part of the what people can look at to see what was going on today.
Yeah, the main idea was that people actually got out there and did something, whether they've done anything before or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good little step in the right direction.
Well, it can't be bad. I think things do have to go slowly. I was all for, I got this idea to have something going on for revisionists on January 27th when they have that big affair at Auschwitz and also at the UN. And my first idea was, well, we'd have our own conference, you know, we'd have a revision. Then just thinking about what that required and what all would, and then I thought, well, have it on the internet, do it on, even that required all kinds of stuff. So sure. It ended up just being a website and saying, well, this is a start for this year, and we'll try to, you know, do more the next year and the next year. But it's you really have to have a crew, and that's where we are where we don't have enough. We don't have enough money, and we don't have enough participants where they can draw on so much for their affairs. They even get government money from all over the place and taxpayers' money. Yeah, it's totally intimidating to do a big operation. And particularly, as I've often said, in this country, we were talking about that, Richard and I, in the United States, it's just so big. And you'd have to do some regional thing or even state thing. In Britain, it's so much smaller, and you can travel around in that country. It doesn't take you 3 or 4 days if you're driving to get from one place to the other. Okay, well, if you have anything more to say, Paul, do, and then we'll let Richard go ahead, finally, with his discussion about demonization.
Yeah, sure. I'd just quickly like to mention the name Chris Donald, which is a name Richard will probably be familiar with. It's so happens that it was on the 15th of March, 2004, 10 years ago, that a white lad called Chris Donald, 15 years old, was kidnapped by four or five Pakistanis, tortured, repeatedly stabbed, and burnt to death. The most shocking crime, race crime in British history. Which there's no fanfare about Chris Donald, like there is Stephen Lawrence, the black drug dealer who got killed. So just felt right to mention his name and keep his memory alive. And if people haven't heard of him, now they know the name, so they could give him a quick search.
Okay. Well, okay, I'll do that myself.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, you stay on, Paul, and okay. Join the show for the rest of the time that we have left. So let's listen to what Richard has to say now. It's your turn now, Richard.
Well, it was good of Paul to mention this young 15-year-old lad in Glasgow, Scotland, Chris Donald, who, as Paul said, 10 years ago today, was kidnapped at random off the streets of Glasgow by a group of Pakistani men and tortured to death. And his final death, he was set alight. Wicked, wicked, wicked. He was kidnapped and tortured at random. The Pakistanis didn't know who he was. They felt angry against British society, even though we've been very generous to them. They felt angry against British society, so they kidnapped this young lad of 15, pulled him off the streets, put him in their car, stabbed him, and then set him alight whilst he was still alive. Absolutely appalling. And it's good that Paul should mention that. And it's good that Paul should give the motivation for this white man's march that he participated in England's second city, Birmingham, that it, the whole purpose is to inspire whites elsewhere to campaign for our wonderful, wonderful white race, which is so much under threat, so much and has been so much betrayed by the anti-white elites who are currently ruining our world. What I'd like to say, Caroline, now is I'd like to respond to the point that you made just before the break when you spoke of the demonization of patriots and the demonization of our nationalist pro-white race, pro-white civilization ideas and policies, the demonization, which in my opinion is what's holding us back. And it is once again the establishment, the wicked British establishment, or if you prefer, the wicked Anglo-American establishment is lying to us. And the lie, which I'd like to address, which is the root of this demonization, and let me introduce this subject by saying that I joined the National Front 40 years ago because I was concerned about immigration. I was concerned about the changing face of Britain, as I explained in your talk 2 weeks ago, how we were losing whole areas, that the problems of the rest of the world were being imported into Britain against the expressed will of the great majority of British people. Their wishes and their interests were ignored by the wicked British establishment. And we formed this little party, this little modest party called the National Front. And our little party was growing growing stronger and stronger. And we were very pleased. And then one day the British establishment played their one and only card. They came out and said the Holocaust word. They said that we in the National Front were like our German predecessors, the Nazis, and that we wanted to murder millions of Jews and millions of all of our opponents. We wanted to murder practically everybody who disagreed with us, just like the Nazis who murdered millions of their opponents. And two points. Firstly, I have never wanted to murder anybody. Neither did the National Front. We didn't want to murder anybody. The immediate effect was that people who had been supportive of us started to look at us askance and think, oh, are you, you say, you look a nice chap, Richard Edmonds, you look a nice, civilized, pleasant Englishman, but are you really a potential mass murderer who wants to murder everybody? And my denials weren't sufficient, I'm afraid, not when 55 million British people were getting this allegation thrown at them day after day.
Well, was the allegation, was it the word Nazi, or was it more than that? I mean,
it was the word Nazi and the word Holocaust. They were saying that our National Front was a Nazi front, and that just as the Nazis murdered 6 million Jews in the Holocaust, we wanted to murder millions of Jews and millions of everybody else. It was the Nazis equals Holocaust. That was the card they played against us. And two things. I have spent practically all my adult life investigating this allegation that the Germans murdered 6 million Jews in the Second World War. And I have spent 40 years of my life investigating this allegation because I saw the damage that it did to our National Front Party. And it is my considered opinion that every white party dedicated to the renaissance of the white world, dedicated to saving our white people, will have to face this question of the Holocaust. Can I continue?
Yes. I'm not making that little bit of noise. I don't know who is. Somebody else.
Okay.
Just go ahead.
Now, I would like to address it from this angle. I'd like to ask two questions. First question, where does the allegation that the Germans murdered 6 million Jews in the Second World War come from? Where does this allegation come from? Second question, what is there to substantiate the allegation that the Germans during the Second World War murdered 6 million Jews? And the answer is this. The allegation that the Germans murdered 6 million Jews was awarded its official seal of approval. That is, it was claimed that this allegation was an authentic fact at the trial that the victorious Allies at the end of the Second World War, the victorious Allies were the United States of America, the Soviet Union, Great Britain and France. The trial that the victorious Allies organized at the end of the Second World War of their defeated German opponents, the trial organized in the German city of Nuremberg in the years immediately following the Second World War, called the Nuremberg Trial. That trial is the source and the origin of the allegation that the Germans murdered 6 million Jews. That trial, where the Allies were simultaneously the judge, jury, prosecution, and hangman in their own case, in their own court. And that trial, that Nuremberg trial of the Allies, the trial of the defeated German leaders, was condemned at the time, in 1945, 1946, was condemned at the time. All wonderful credit to them, was condemned at the time by principled leading Americans. And all credit to them. No lesser person than the Chief Justice of the US Supreme Court, Harlan F. Stone, condemned the Allies' Nuremberg trials as a lynch mob.
And yes, but you know what? Some of them said things like that, and it was very brave and wonderful of them. And it's great that, you know, we can say that. But they didn't, like, resign, or they didn't make a big issue of it. They just, in some cases, it was said privately. They didn't make a big public statement of it. In some cases, it may have been a public statement, but I don't know. So, I mean, they didn't make the big deal out of it that they would have to do for it to make any impact.
Well, let me continue. The fact is, Harlan F. Stone unfortunately died shortly afterwards. He may well have said it in private, but he still said it to other lawyers. Because we know that he said it. We know that he said it. And unfortunately, he died a bit later. But a man who spoke up publicly was the U.S. Senator Robert Taft. And Robert Taft condemned the Nuremberg trial as a travesty of justice and as a perversion of justice. And he said America's participation in those Nuremberg trials is a blot on the honor of the United States of America. And he further said that in the future, Europeans will condemn the USA for its participation in that trial.
Well, let me also point out, well, there's a little break here, that it's interesting that the four nations that conducted the Nuremberg Tribunal, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time, were the same nations on the little chart I put for this program, that were allied. The United States wasn't on there yet, but when it did come into the World War I, it was on that side. That was the Entente, made up of Britain, France, Russia as the large countries, and then the U.S. joined them. And it was always the United States that made the difference in winning the war.
Well, that, yes, the fact
is... Isn't that interesting, though, that those were the threesome that was on the one side, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy were on the alliance, were on the other side, and... But when the United States came into the war, they didn't have much hope left after that, I guess. Although they really didn't need to surrender when they did. They didn't, they didn't need to do that, but there's, we'll have to go into all those details another time, but.
Can I just say something about
the
Holocaust Lord Richard mentioned in regard to British political parties? I think that's very true what he said. We have to deal with this Holocaust in quotes or the Holo hoax because we cannot move away from this tough subject. As we saw on Question Time when Nick Griffin went on there, he didn't deal with the subject. He had in 1997 when he was interviewed, said he didn't believe it. He said he reckons only a couple hundred thousand Jews died on the Eastern Front, partisans and so forth. And then he changed his view in front of 8 million viewers, all potential voters, and says, I do believe it now. And when they said, why, what's changed your view? He says, I don't know. That is nowhere near good enough. We need people like Richard and the work you do, Carolyn, and also people like Eric Hunt, who you had on the other week, who did that documentary, The Last Days of the Big Lie. As soon as I saw the title for that, The Last Days of the Big Lie, I thought that's very good, because I think we are in the last days of the big lie. Another multimedia work, which people should watch, is The Greatest Story Never Told, about Adolf Hitler. That, again, is the story, but from the German perspective, from a sensible perspective, not what you get on the History Channel. And it's about 6 hours long altogether. I think there's 26 parts. So yeah. In that way,
I've never watched it beyond the first couple of the first two parts or three parts or something. And then I had a bad impression because I don't like to see Adolf Hitler portrayed by actors because they're never right. They're never any good. And I thought this one was particularly bad, you know, showing the young Hitler or something.
Yeah, they used a lot of scenes out of the
I didn't like it at all. But then I'm aware, and I think this is correct, that after that part, it's all documentary about the war and so on, and gives a pretty the right perspective. It's not there's no more of all that acting going on, right?
That's right, and it points out the 6 million figure mentioned earlier. How that was mentioned what over 100 times in various Jewish papers. You know, 6 million souls.
Oh yeah, from 1896 on, or something like that, or maybe even earlier.
Exactly,
it goes back that far.
So few people know this. And we have the truth on our side, so there's no reason not to attack. All this kind of being defensive or shirking it to our people who do know the truth, it looks cowardly. And to the people who don't know the truth, well, it just reinforces what they've been fed all these years. So when you do get a nationalist party doing well, like the National Front in the late 70s or the BNP in the late 2000s, mid-2000s, that's all they have to do is bring out the Holocaust and everything collapses. So we can't afford that to happen.
Well, I'm glad you – I was going to go back to that too, Paul. And I wanted to thank Richard for saying that. I didn't know before the show or previously that was his view quite that directly. And so I'm really happy to find out that it is, because I've been saying that for quite a while to the people who want to avoid the Holocaust. Well, you know, that we can't avoid it. We need to face up to it. And, of course, then I even copied Alex Linder from VNN and saying there's no way out but through the Holocaust. That's pretty good.
Oh, is that where that came from?
Yeah, he had a different thing. Anyway, I really sincerely believe that, and I'm glad you believe that, Richard.
Well, I like that slogan. In my opinion, the best way out of any problem is through the problem.
That's right.
Let me just conclude on this Nuremberg
trials.
Yeah. Because why? Why did the number one judge in the United States pour contempt on the Nuremberg trial as organized by the Allies? Why was he supported by a senior member of the Republican Party who publicly spoke out against the Nuremberg trials? Because the trials were a lynch mob. The Allies gave themselves these allies, the Soviet Union, the United States, Britain and France, gave themselves the right at their trial, which they organized, they gave themselves the right to discard the usual rules of evidence, which are the basis of Anglo-Saxon law, the law of the United States and the law of Great Britain. The standard rules of evidence were discarded. Any allegation printed by the Allies in their newspapers, any allegation made by the Allies at the trial had to be accepted on face value as public knowledge. Everybody knows that the Germans were gassing people because it's in the Allies, it's in the British newspapers, it's in the French newspapers, it's in the Russian newspapers. Everybody knows. Allegations were accepted at face value as public knowledge, and they were accepted as having probative value. And the result of that was, that men, Germans, were found guilty and hanged on allegations of their committing atrocities, which were later found out to have no basis in fact whatsoever. In addition to that, to their undying shame, the Allies used torture to extract self-condemning confessions of guilt from helpless prisoners. Now, Caroline, you just said that these fine men who criticized the Nuremberg and other such trials as organized by the Allies in post-war Germany, you said that they all spoke in private. There was one man who published his findings to the world in a press conference that he held in New York City in, I think, 1947 or 1948. Shall I talk about that case?
Sure. Yeah.
There were rumors that the United States investigators questioning German POWs were torturing their German POWs most viciously. And these rumors of torture committed by American investigators of German POWs became so insistent that the American Department of Justice, the American Department of the American Army, Justice Department, JAD, I think the initials are, sent a team of lawyers to examine the conditions of German POWs who were being investigated by the investigators of the US Army in a camp just outside Munich, in Dachau, Munich. And this judge, by the name of Edward Van Roden, returned to the United States of America, held a press conference in New York City, and said, I examined 139 German POWs, prisoners of the American Army, who were being questioned and investigated by US investigators, and those 139 German POWs had their testicles crushed beyond repair. Now, there's an example.
And what was this? Would you spell his name? Edward Van Roden?
Edward Van Roden. R-O-D-E-N. Edward Van Roden. If you want these facts, get them from Arthur Butz's book, The Hopes of the 20th Century.
Well, I've read that, but I knew about the testicle crushing, but I didn't remember that there was a man's name and that he had actually said he had examined and there was that many of them. That's terrible.
Can I give you another example briefly? I've given you an example of the Americans torturing German POWs, to extract confessions of guilt, yeah? The British captured a former commandant of Auschwitz camp, Rudolf Höss. British captured Rudolf Höss. They beat him almost to death. Then a British doctor said stop. A British army doctor said stop or you'll kill him. They gave Rudolf Höss 3 days to recover from his beatings. And they said to Rudolf Höss, we want you to sign a piece of paper saying that you murdered 4 million Jews at Auschwitz. If you don't sign this bit of paper, we will beat you to death. We will hand your wife over to the Russians to be raped to death. And we will hand your children to be given to the Russians. We will bring them up in an orphanage, a Russian orphanage, and they won't even know who their parents were. They won't even know they're Germans. Rudolf Höss, of course, signed the piece of paper. And Rudolf Höss was the key witness at the Nuremberg trials, stating 4 million were murdered at Auschwitz. As soon as he made his useful statement at the Nuremberg trials, he was then hung to keep his mouth shut. So if people want to know the veracity of the allegation that the Germans murdered 6 million Jews, it is a propaganda lie invented by the Allies. I will say here, I am not denying that Jewish people suffered in the Second World War. The fact is, the Second World War was the most destructive war in the history of mankind. 50 million people were killed in that war. Ask the British government why they declared it in 39. Meanwhile, amongst that 50 million killed in the Second World War, there were, of course, Jews, and there were also Germans, and also Jews, Germans, Gentiles.
I will say, Richard, that whatever amount of Jewish suffering there was, which is completely exaggerated, because a lot of even going to camps and everything was not as bad as they make it out to be. You know, they were taken out of harm's way too. But the, whatever Jewish suffering there was, it was not anywhere near what German suffering there was, and that's on a proportional basis too. The Germans suffered far worse in so many ways than these Jews did in their concentration camps.
Well, in broadly, I would absolutely agree with that. And we could talk about the sufferings of the German people. We could talk about the sufferings of everybody in that Second World War. There's just a final statement one can make here. This Holocaust lie is used to besmirch, in the first instance, it's a blood libel against the German people. The German people are fine people. They are not monsters. They are not murderers. The allegation has got no foundation in truth whatsoever. It is a propaganda lie invented by the wicked Anglo-American establishment. So in the first instance, it's a blood libel against the German people. In the second instance, it is a libel against all patriots, American patriots, British patriots, German patriots, whereby one comes along with one's patriotism and they say, oh, you're not a patriot, you are a Nazi, and you want to murder millions like your forebears did. That is one long lie. So the Holocaust allegation has got many uses. And the major use, as far as I am concerned, is that it is used as a weapon to destroy and to discredit and to destroy patriotism. And that is why I have spent 40 years of my life investigating the truth of it. Just let me say, I know that time is running out. Let me just say a short sentence, a short statement. May I, Caroline?
Sure. We have plenty. Okay.
So we've discussed mass immigration into the white world, which is destroying us. We discussed the two world wars started by the wicked British establishment without any justification whatsoever. We've discussed briefly the Holocaust and proven that it is an allegation without any substance. Where does all this leave us? Where does this leave us? And I will say, where does all this leave us? Two world, when I say us, I mean you, me, Paul, and 500 million whites in this world and the rest of the world if they want to take a serious interest in this. Where does this leave us? Two world wars later, and it leaves us here. Our politicians are nothing but liars. They launch world wars that kill and maim millions, and now our politicians, our lying politicians, are now flooding all white countries with millions of aliens and foreigners, so that we are becoming strangers in our own cities, strangers in our own countries, in a process which, if it's continued, will lead inexorably to the extinction of us whites. That is what we're talking about. When we look at the last 100 years from that baleful declaration of war made by the British government in August 1914, we of our generation can look back over 100 years of a process, two world wars, mass colored immigration, which is systematically leading to our extinction. So the process is genocidal. I really appreciate, Caroline, being on your show, talking to you, talking to Paul and all your other listeners. And And I know that this is recorded, so that wonderful people...
Oh, it's not recorded. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we're live, but it's also being recorded, right?
But you can listen to it later, can't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, yes.
Sure, that's what I meant by recorded. Yeah. Friend and foe alike, pleased to know you. So, what life is wonderful. Life is wonderful because we have chances and we can win. We can absolutely, our white people, they're wonderful people. We've done wonderful things and we will solve these problems. We will solve them. I have no doubt whatsoever. Nice talking to you, Carol.
Can I just bring up?
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
What, to me, to my mind, what is almost as important or even more important than this Holocaust telling people the truth is why the Western powers actually declared war on Hitler. Now, we're told in school it was to do with Poland and other factors, but people who have studied will find it was mainly because Adolf Hitler threw out the bankers and he didn't have that private central bank like the Federal Reserve is, like the Bank of England is, and all of a sudden when he did that, the nation was no longer in usury, and through fairly simple methods, really, getting people back to work and getting factories working and giving people very low interest loans. What a wonderful recovery that country had. That, to my understanding, was the real reason why Hitler had to be smashed. That was why Churchill, who was brought and paid for, as David Irving points out, by the focus group, Jewish group. And I think that is also important to explain to people and get across, especially being now people are saying to themselves in America, in Europe, in England, why are we so poor? You know, we've got all this history, all these inventions, all this trade, but we're still poor. The living standards are going backwards, not forwards. It's not supposed to be like that. So we can now link, I think we can explain to people, this is the reason why you have these bankers, these rich families like the Rothschilds, who, if you look back, was involved in both wars, the starting of the wars. And that, I would argue, is also very important to get across.
Well, you know, in the first hour, Paul, we Richard brought up the, let's see, where's all that? But he brought up because I was asking, why are the establishment whites doing this? You know, what is our answer? Are they psychopaths or what is it? And it did come out that, Richard said that they wanted to be a nation like this big nation in South America, which I understand as being Brazil, which has a very small overclass and a small underclass of criminals. And then a large number of working people who are productive and are supporting the rest of it. I guess they can't get rid of that small underclass of criminals, or they want that underclass to be there and to use it. That's what I would think. And then we were discussing what they got out of this and so on. And in his mind, it was, and I'm speaking for you, Richard, so you can break in here if you want. It was that, they just, in a kind of a human nature way, people want to be winners, and when they find a way to be at the very top and live fabulously well, and we also brought in that they don't have to worry about breaking the law or ever being punished for anything they do, and that made me think of all the sexual...
Jimmy Savile and all the...
Yeah, that kind of thing that goes on, and much more than people want to realize. And I was saying, well, do their children then are being brought up in this? Do they just carry on the same way? And those of us who are in the middle, we just carry on the same way too, not questioning that much. Well, there's that. But Ian, you're wanting to bring in the banking thing, but that in a way that brings in another group of people. But in another way, it also brings in the same thing of owning all the wealth, of owning everything, and being this fabulously wealthy small elite globally. So nobody, once you make it global and you've got everybody trapped in this, nobody can come up against you. You know, nobody can challenge you.
Mm. Well, who was the Balfour Declaration? Who sent it to Lord Balfour, or who did Lord Balfour send it to? It was Lord Rothschild.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, where does Israel come in all of this, Richard?
Well, that's something else again. We haven't so far met Israel on this evening, have we? Perhaps we should.
Yeah, we don't have time to do it, and you're right. And I don't want to get too many topics going on here, so I want to keep it pretty much about World War One and the causes. But there's be people who bring these things up and want to see it in a somewhat different way. But I do think it's important. I agree with you, Richard, that it is this. It is the establishment whites, and it is the people who were running the wars and so on. But we have to say that what people were behind that, and that's where it gets conspiracy like. It gets cloudy. You have to surmise things. You can't exactly prove it. And some people want to stay away from that. That's what comes up. But I think that we made a very good overview. I'm very pleased, really, with what's been said. I think we've made a very good overview of how World War One, 100 years ago this year, set us on a path that we're still on, and it's not a good path for us, is it?
It certainly is not. It is certainly not a good path. We've got to get off this path. We're all agreed on that. And we've got to educate our fellow whites, and we've got to inspire them with the sort of activities that Paul was talking about. We have to wake the whites out of their lethargy. We have to give them some spirit. We have to put some political ideas in their head. If you imagine the whites race to be like a sleeping beauty in one of those fairy tales. Yes, there's the sleeping beauty. She's been asleep for 100 years. What this sleeping beauty needs is a prince charming to come along and to kiss her on her cheek, and then she'll open her eyes, and I believe they live happily ever after. That's how the story ends, which my mother used to tell us. Isn't that right, Caroline? They live happily ever after.
Yeah, that's the story, but I don't know if I would.
Ooh, it's true. It's true. Absolutely true.
I don't know if we're just sleeping, and I don't know if people can wake up and find themselves back where they were, because the world has changed and our countries have changed, and we're not white countries anymore. How do we deal with that? I think that's the serious problem, and why these people will go out now and put up these signs. Diversity equals white genocide, and try to get people to see that you can't mix people together. And certainly they're being brought into our countries. It's definitely an attack against white people. There's no doubt about that.
Well, that Barbara Spector in Sweden even says so, doesn't she? She's got a Jewish organization there, and she says, you know, Europe's going into a multicultural mode. And I believe that the 30,000 Africans that Israel wanted to get rid of, she did the paperwork to get them to Sweden. And Sweden and Norway are now the rape capitals of Europe. And it's not Swedes and Norwegians doing the raping, that's for sure. So that's genocide. That's a weapon of war. Rape is a weapon of war.
All right. And, you know, we got our 60-second warning there, so we're working our way to 30 seconds. So this gives me plenty of time to thank Richard Edmonds for coming on and being such a great guest, and to thank you, too, Paul, for coming on here and doing your part. I think I told the listeners in the beginning it was going to be a great program, or I had a great program for them, and I think it's turned out to be one. And we did build up quite a nice listenership, too. So we've had a successful afternoon. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you, Kevin. Okay,
thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, we wish our listeners so long, and we'll see you again. Well, Paul's program is tomorrow. Yeah, I was trying to think what day it was. Be sure to listen to Paul tomorrow at the afternoon.